Hey everybody, today is Thursday, April 26, 2018, and this is episode 380 of the Android Central podcast. My name is Russell Holly. I'm taking over for Dan this week as he is far away in another time zone, and I think it's actually tomorrow where he is, if I remember correctly.
Tomorrow or yesterday or something.
Yeah, something. Time is funny.
I expect them lotto results in my email, Daniel.
Yeah, it should have been on that already. We got a lot of stuff going on this week, and we're going to try and get it done as quickly and efficiently as possible because I'm going to go see Infinity War tonight. I don't know about the rest of y'all.
I'm not, man. But I know that's a thing that you would enjoy doing.
Yeah, that is going to be a fun thing. Getting everybody who is here on the podcast today, we have the irreplaceable Jerry Hildebrand.
Oh, I'm replaceable. Don't let me
You're
think
not,
differently.
You're not. I tried. I set up cardboard boxes once, and it didn't work at all.
Okay, well, that's nice to know.
And we have the equally irreplaceable Andrew Martinick.
And I'm partially here. My voice sounds probably okay now, but it's going to fade. So
Andrew,
you know,
will disappear at some point, but he will actually have been talking the whole time. We just will stop hearing him. It will be very sad.
Slowly lower the gain on my mic until I'm gone. By the
have to go back to video so he can sign.
Jim is going to have to look at the waveform and just, you know, kind of have to guess as to when your voice actually went out.
This is the point where Andrew's voice died.
That's right. Yeah, we can figure it out right here. So we had a busy week last week. I guess since we know that your voice works now, we should start with you, Andrew. You were in Brazil, taking a good look at the stuff happening with Motorola.
Yeah, and I know that you guys talked about this on the last episode a little bit, but it was just a little bit different for me. I didn't go down to Brazil just to see the new Moto G6 and Moto E5, but more to get a feel for a different side of Motorola's business. We think about Motorola as being kind of an also-ran company. I mean, we talk about Samsung a lot, and of course in the US we focus on other kind of scrappy enthusiast focused companies like OnePlus and things like that. We'll get to them later, but Motorola is just a lot bigger than we think of it. So I go down to Brazil, where Motorola has a huge office complex kind of situation going on in Sao Paulo. That's kind of their offices for all of Latin America, and it's a completely different feeling. You go down there and all of a sudden Motorola is a huge deal, like it never left. We had this, Motorola used to be this massive name in the United States and Western Europe, and then it really faded really before Google bought them. But especially when Google bought them, everything got pared back. And that never really happened in Latin America. There was a dip there, but it wasn't huge. And then when the Moto G launched, they absolutely took off. And then Lenovo acquired them, and everybody was worried about Motorola, going away entirely. And it just continued to climb massively. So 2016 and 2017 were so huge with Motorola that they're number one or number two in market share across Latin America. And even in the biggest markets in Brazil and Argentina and Mexico and all of these huge countries with hundreds of millions of people in them collectively, Motorola has like 30% market share or 50% market share in some markets. And that just, I think, seems crazy to us as people in the U.S. in particular, where, yeah, you see like Moto G's around, but it's a little different when I go to Sao Paulo and you just see Motorola phones everywhere. Because, and this is in a city of 12, 13 million people where Motorola phones stand out. And you have a situation where Android, just in general, is like 93% of the Brazilian market. And this is also a situation where these countries don't have smartphone penetration like the US, where you know, smartphone penetration in the US is going to be like over 100% at some point. I'm sure the numbers will work out where on average people have more than one phone.
It'll be 1.2 phones.
Exactly. Just like having, you know, 2.5 kids or whatever on average, right? It's going to be something like that. But in Brazil, people don't really have phones at that level. It's like 50%-ish. Of course, in the cities, it's far closer to 100%. But anyway, and this is all built around the Moto G. So I had a little nugget that came out from talking to the new president of Motorola, Sergio Buniac, where he said that they've sold over 70 million Moto Gs, which...
Yeah,
I believe it.
I had to double check this number twice with them because I wanted to make sure, you know, I didn't want to quote him if he misspoke.
Sure.
Because I looked back and I looked at numbers from, you know, people had reported this big milestone when Motorola announced with, I think, the third generation or the fourth generation even, they had sold like 7 million Moto Gs. And this was only a couple of years ago.
Which at that time was still considered a pretty significant success.
Yeah, absolutely. And we were like, wow, you know, we had these stories where, you know, the Moto G has sold, or Motorola has sold more Moto Gs than any other single phone in its entire history and, you know, crazy stuff like that. And then within the next 3 years, they had sold 65 million more, which is absolutely crazy it's crazy just in, you know, if you break that out, that's 12 million per year, which would be a good clip. But when your first 3 years were only like 6 or 7 million, that's even crazier because it's like more 20 million a year in the most recent years. And it's even crazier when you realize that that's localized to just a few markets. It's not like Samsung selling the A series and J series phones, which sell in just massive, massive numbers, but those sell worldwide in massive numbers. Motorola is selling, you know, we could just say 20 million Moto Gs a year, just, you know, primarily in Latin America. I was talking to our writer Harish, who lives in India, and he was like, yeah, Motorola is growing here, but Motorola is still down in like the number five position. Similar to the way it's like number five or six or something in the US. It's very, very small. So this huge market penetration of the Moto G is like all localized to a few different regions. And that was just extremely surprising to me. I had no idea that it was that crazy, but now you kind of understand why Motorola focuses so much on the Moto G.
And I know Andrew realizes this. It makes sense. I know a lot of people listening will have never been to South America or Latin America, however you want to say it. But I know Andrew has, and in a past life, my company had an office, you know, several offices in South America. It's people just like you. They go to work, they go to school, they need a smartphone, they need it to do all these things, but their currency doesn't have the same buying power that our dollar does. Motorola gave them a damn good phone at a good price. And it took off, so they were smart, and this is the reward they get.
Well, and it's in some cases that actually goes a little bit further, as I understand it. I have a friend of mine whose spouse is an artist from Argentina and has said similar things about how popular Motorola was down there. But I think the explanation she gave me, and Andrew, you probably know a lot more about this, is that that importing other phones is just horribly expensive, even when they are comparably priced to the Moto G. Like the act of importing them from other countries is just very, very expensive down there. And Motorola can avoid that because they build the Moto Gs in country.
Yes, exactly. And that's one of the main reasons why Motorola has such a huge marketing and just overall office presence in Sao Paulo, Brazil, is because they do all of this local manufacturing. They do very similar stuff in, I think, like Argentina and Mexico and Uruguay and, you know, some of these other big countries down there where you're exactly right. Import tariffs are so high that it just makes sense to only do things locally. And the companies that are like Motorola and have the scale to be able to do that instantly benefit from it. they have very similar things in India. And so you'll see that with like Xiaomi phones and things like that. They'll, you know, and BlackBerry went through this a bunch when they did, you know, their launches in India. You have to do things locally, and, you know, you can argue about whether or not that's a good idea, but the companies that have done it have massively benefited. So Motorola went all in and did this local manufacturing. I bought a Moto G6 Plus there. It's a Brazilian phone. And so Motorola is in second place in Brazil behind Samsung, but they're like 20 percentage points higher than the next highest. I don't even know which one it is. They're so far ahead. There's this huge gap there. It's not as much of a mixed market, which is very interesting. So it's not a very mixed market, similar to the US, but Motorola just happens to be one of the big players rather than one of the small players in that respect.
That's really cool to see how that all plays out. Like to see just such a staggering difference in global market that you can't help but notice it when you're there.
Oh, I mean, it's a situation where, you know, I go to the airport and you see people glued to their Motorola phone in the same way that every single person in, you know, the SeaTac airport in Seattle is glued to their iPhone. It's that staggering. We see that many people, and I get picked up by my driver from the airport, and he's using a Moto G5, and you know, go to the hotel, and everybody in the lobby has a Motorola phone. It's you don't expect that. It's across the city. It's everywhere that I went. It was just like that. And like I said, it's because there's not that much diversity in smartphones there, which is really interesting. I kind of expected more of a mix of all these low-end phones. I didn't expect to see lots of high-end phones. I really didn't see any that many high-end phones. I saw lots of cheap Samsung phones and cheap and middle-of-the-road Motorola phones. I didn't see a lot of high-end phones from anybody, but I also didn't see any like cheap LG phones or Alcatel phones or anything like that. It really is a 1-2 punch of Samsung and Motorola there. And I just think that it's important to express that to everybody else that thinks, you know, Motorola, you know, what are they? They're number, you know, 5 or 6 or something in the US. They've got 5% market share or something like that. They're not even around. Well, if you look at other parts of the world, they clearly have figured out how to do it in some parts. You know, the question is, of course, if they can bring that to the US and Europe.
Now, is that a dual SIM market down there?
For the most part, people still, they like to have it. It's just like India where, well, not just like, but it's similar in India where a lot of people use dual SIM phones and they like to have that option. So that's basically, since they're already making phones for Brazil in particular, they just make them dual SIM because that's just the way they do it. I didn't get the feeling that, I mean, at least the people that I talked to, I didn't get the feeling that everybody relies on dual SIM. They just like to have the option. And so since you're making a Brazilian version, you might as well just make it dual SIM.
It's interesting. We get that question every once in a while. Why aren't dual SIM phones like even remotely popular here in the US? And one of the answers that we gave earlier this year was that it might become something that we consider doing in some phones when eSIM starts to take on, because there will likely be phones that are like hybrid eSIM and physical SIM for a little while for that switch. But it turns out that might actually not happen. Jerry, you probably know a bit more about this. eSIM tech is on hold here in the US because kids can't get along.
Yeah, it's not unexpected. I mean, let's be honest. It's not, they've pretty much halted the finalization of, you know, what they want to do and any larger rollout because Verizon and AT&T are trying to lock eSIMs to their network. There was a fear that would happen when eSIM technology first, what was it, an iPad, I think, was the first consumer. And then, you know, it's almost like a DRM. A lot of the people I talk to, that's the kind of things we worry about. And then it turned out that, you know, it didn't really happen. Apple did a good job. The Pixel 2 does an excellent job with an eSIM, but now AT&T and Verizon are seeing that it might become a real thing, and they're doing what they do best. And there's really, I mean, it can't happen. We can't allow the stopping this technology from becoming broader is the right thing to do until this gets straightened out.
Sure. So in the meantime, this doesn't impact anybody that's using any company that's using eSIM right now.
No.
Any Project Fi users who are using, who are using a Pixel and getting that kind of eSIM benefit, they're still fine.
Absolutely. I'm sure that Verizon and AT&T don't even like the idea of having phones that can use more than one network at a time on their network, but they have got with the GMSA and they had plans to lock this technology to their carrier, but it hasn't happened yet. Your phone, if you buy a Pixel 2 tomorrow or an iPhone, it's not going to be locked.
This was always the worry that a lot of people, I still have a little bit about eSIM, was the carriers were always going to find a way to try to make this another way to lock people in.
Yep.
And people already have such a, like, average people, not us, not anybody listening to this podcast, average people don't even know still what a SIM card is, especially in the West. Like, we don't think about things that way. My parents, you know, they break their phone and they get a new phone. Like, they go into the carrier and, like, hey, here's my phone. Like, I need to switch phones. All the person at the counter does is take out the SIM and move it. But they don't understand how that works. And if you obscure it further with eSIM without very strict rules about what they can do, they're just going to take advantage of people.
And you can lock an eSIM. I'm not sure if this applies to all of them, but I know the ones in the iPhone, they can be carrier locked, but they're not that way by default. And it's kind of like, AT&T would give you a special deal if you agree to have your phone locked to them. That can be done. I don't know that it ever has been, but it can be.
It's also particularly worrisome from the education perspective, like Andrew pointed out. You know, this is, you walk into a Verizon store today to buy a new phone, and if you already have an account, they act like they can't just hand you the phone.
Yeah.
Like, it's a regular argument. The last time I was in there, when I bought the blue Pixel 2, I walked in there, I was just like, I've got cash in hand, I want to hand you $700, and I want you to hand me a phone, and I don't want any other part of this transaction to happen. Don't even put it on my account. Just, and they were just like, well, we can't give it to you without activating it.
Yeah, that's
and
crazy.
I was like, you're wrong. You have I can activate it right here. I can take the SIM from the phone in my pocket and put it in, and your network will immediately do its thing and it will start working. And the woman behind the counter, it was as though I were speaking in tongues. She was just like, no, that's absolutely not how this happens. We have to activate it. There's stuff that we have to do over here. And it's every single time I walk into a Verizon store. And so I am concerned when eSIM becomes a thing, because it becomes even more like magic.
Yep.
For people who don't know any better, because at that point it'll be a couple of buttons that they push on a keyboard instead of having to stick a pin in the phone. But yeah, it's not cool the way that they act like it's so big a deal when it's not.
It's against the terms of service. When you reset your phone, you read these little things that pop up and you agree to them. If you look into those, part of it says that you acknowledge you've read and understand this. And if the woman or man behind the counter at Verizon is the one setting it up, there's no way you've read and understood it.
Right. Yeah, because I see it all the time. They go through the complete setup process without ever showing the phone to the person.
They ask you your email. The last phone I bought through a carrier was the Evo 4G.
and
you had to. It was from Sprint. And they literally asked me for my Gmail password to set the phone up. And I'm like, what? And they're like, yeah, we need to finish setting this up for
you. No way.
And Android needs your Gmail to work. And I'm like, well, hand me the phone. I'll put it in there. Okay, fine. That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, it's scary to see how that process gets handled now. And yeah, I'm glad that instead of trying to muscle this through with rules that are going to cause way more problems, that the ESIM process is just kind of halting, because
yep,
these guys are going to fight over this for a while.
And the GMSA, that organization is designed to help carriers get what they want, you know, on paper. But they have always been pretty cool about being friendly to the consumer, too. So it's nice to see that's what they're doing this time, too. They've got no problem halting this until it all gets sorted. They're not pushing against the Justice Department here.
It's weird. It's weird, weird, weird. We had a bunch of other weird news this week with Amazon. I'm going to briefly go over the one and then we'll dive into the other. Amazon Key has been expanded to cars, which it's basically certain cars that have the ability to remotely open the trunk will, you know, Amazon's delivery drivers will have the ability to walk up to your car and open the trunk and put the present that you have ordered into the trunk so that you have presents when you get to your car, instead of leaving it on a porch where someone can just walk up and take it. I have the exact same response to this that I have to Amazon Key for the Home, which is to laugh and then say no and never, ever try this service.
Correct.
But you know, there is a, you know, there are people who have problems getting stuff stolen off of their porch, and you know, maybe this is an option for them, but it's definitely not an option for me.
I had somebody tell me that exact same thing, that they regularly get packages stolen from their porch.
Yeah.
And they said, this is Amazon. If something goes wrong, I know exactly who to talk to when I'm talking, or who to talk about when I'm talking to the police department. When it's stolen from my porch, I have no idea.
Yeah.
And that made me pause and think that's absolutely right. I'm with Russell and Andrew. And no way some delivery driver is going to get the key to my house or the code
even a temporary virtual key. Like that's, yeah, there's no way.
The one nice middle ground for this is what they already, Amazon already does with Amazon Fresh. I'm in Seattle, so they pilot a whole bunch of different stuff. I don't know if they do this anywhere else, but they have actual Amazon Fresh pickup places where you can, you drive up and they just have this little kind of like it's like a drive-in for food. You just pull into a designated spot. They see your license plate and then you pop the trunk and they put your groceries that they've already packed up in the trunk and close the trunk. And then you just drive away and you've already paid for it.
I get to try that next month because we've got a new distribution center here, and they're also putting Amazon Fresh in the town that I live in, and that's cool.
I think I'd be a bigger fan of that.
Yeah, because you're there, and so you're scheduling a pickup time just like you would schedule an Amazon Fresh delivery or, you know, any other Amazon delivery. So all they do is they just deliver it to the pickup location, and then they have to pay, you know, somebody to stand there and take your bags out.
Yeah.
But that's at least you're there and you know what's going on, and it's a specific time and place that you know you can go pick it up. It's very similar to the way Amazon lockers work already.
And
you know,
that's what I was thinking. It would be fairly simple to do the same thing with a locker for other goods that can be same day delivery, and then maybe expand that into all Prime orders. Have a, you know, in a strip mall somewhere, like a UPS store, except it's an Amazon store.
That's kind of what they do with lockers, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Isn't that how Amazon lockers? We have one near us and I've never actually used it. But
I think that, well, yeah, so the way those work is very similar, but the problem is they're for very small packages for the most part. They have a variety of different, but they have one that's maybe a foot and a half cubed. But it's like, you know, we get a lot of packages that are larger than that from Amazon, especially with the insane way that they package things in giant boxes for no reason. But this is, you know, this is for the person that doesn't want to go do that, I guess. But they're willing to give up access to the trunk of their car. I just don't feel like it's worth it.
Amazon switched to weird padded envelopes here. Over the last couple of weeks, and it's making me really unhappy because they've started taking stuff like my protein bars and shoving them in my mailbox.
Oh,
because they're in this, instead of being in a box that would not have fit, they are in a padded envelope. and the padded envelope fits in the mailbox, so they just put it in there, and I'm not a fan. I don't know what to do about it yet.
I'll trade with you. I just ordered a USB-C SD card reader for my Pixelbook, and you can imagine how big it is. It's on a dongle. It's maybe 4 inches long. It came in a 20 by 20 by 20 box filled with filled with inflated balloons, and I was at a loss for words.
I get the whole argument behind it, because I've talked to Amazon engineers, and like the whole thing with that box, with those weird boxes is like, if they have a package, they have a truck going to a specific place, yeah, they put things in weird boxes to fill the Tetris grid. But yeah, it's so absurd. It just feels so wasteful when it shows up like that.
Yeah, and I know why they do it too. It's they, you know, if you don't fill that hole, another package is going to get broken.
Right. Yeah, you gotta fill the Tetris block.
But when it shows up at your door in this huge box, you gotta just scratch your head.
That's so weird. What I did like from them this week is we got Amazon Echo Dot Kids Edition, which I giggled at when I first saw, because my kids already have an Echo Dot in their room, so I didn't know. Like, aside, they like the picture. I was super, super guilty of looking at the headline and the picture and just kind of rolling my eyes and then almost moved on. But then I clicked it and looked. So they come in three different colors now, which I dig. It's all of the primary colors that you see for the other kids edition stuff that Amazon does. You've got the green, the red, and the blue. We don't have a purple yet, which made my daughter very unhappy.
And it looks like a thicker case that if you knock it off a table, it's cool.
Yeah, it's got like a rubbery thing, but the Amazon Echo Dots, they're so small and plasticky anyways. I just can't even imagine how one would get broken that way. But it's cool to see that. The software part is the part that's interesting. They added the kids limitations, you know, parental controls to it, so you can limit when the kids are able to do that, which makes sense. None of my kids have ever woken up at 2 a.m. and started asking Alexa weird questions, but I know parents with kids that definitely would do that if given the opportunity. So the parental lockdown for that is kind of cool. But then they gave access to Amazon's free time service, which is their like unlimited pay per month or unlimited access to certain content for a monthly fee. And it's all audiobooks. So the kids with an Echo Dot in their room now have unlimited access to kid-friendly audiobooks for, I think it's like $3 a month.
I get it. I love the software, and I like the parental controls for buying more than you, because when I got an Echo, the first stupid thing I did was order a $2,000 Martin guitar that I had to call somebody. I have one click turned on because I use the app on my phone.
Right.
And it just did it. And I had no idea. I can't afford to spend that. My wife's going to kill me. What do I do? So I had to call them. But my thing here is, this is software. Can they roll this out to the existing Echo Dot?
Right.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, and I'm sure that they will.
Yeah, that's what I'm waiting for.
Yeah, I would not, you know, this is the same thing we saw with the Fire tablets.
Yep.
When the original versions of the Fire tablets didn't have the kid-friendly settings, and then when the kids' versions of the Fire tablets came out, the update rolled back to the existing Fire tablets, and you were able to set up free time and all of that stuff. So I have every confidence that the existing Echo Dots, that there will just be parental control buttons within the next couple of weeks, and that it'll go just fine. But I like this focus on, in particular, the audiobooks and the parental controls. For each one of these, I think it's cool that they know that enough kids are using these that they can push forward and do this. I'm not sure that any of the other companies making smart speakers can really say the same right now.
One thing this does is, if you're a parent with a young child and you never thought about buying them their own Echo Dot, this catches your attention, and hey, I can get this, set it up, make sure, you know, the kid doesn't accidentally order a million things from Amazon, but they can talk with Alexa and use the free time and interact and hear stories and have a good time with it. You know, that's a thing a lot of parents probably haven't thought of before.
Yeah, and it also crosses that weird line where for some parents where you're letting tech be the babysitter.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same, you know, like don't just leave a kid in the room with the TV on. So there are some, I've talked to a bunch of parents about this, and there are some parents who are really hesitant about like kind of the unfiltered access where kids can just kind of sit in the room and do whatever they want. But, you know, the approach to books instead of, mm-hmm. Instead of television, I like that. And I still say the number one thing that the Echo Dot gets used for in my house, in the kids' room, is the intercom feature.
Yeah.
I can be in the kitchen, and I am. It's like every single morning I'm in the kitchen making breakfast for the kids, and I can say drop in on the upstairs Echo, and it gives that little pulse and it acts like an alarm clock for them. And then they hear my voice and they, you know, I know that they've responded, that they're actually awake and they're moving. Like I love that.
You know what I have to do? I have to lean out the door and yell up the stairs, Terry.
Yeah.
Turn on the microphone on the Echo. I want to talk to you, because I keep those things shut off.
That's really funny. But yeah, I'm glad that they're doing this. And I think it'll be interesting to see if Google responds at all. I Google doesn't really have, they're just now getting into audiobooks. The same way that Amazon has. So I would be interested to see if they respond somehow.
They almost have to.
Maybe it'd be interesting to see, you know, how, you know, especially the way that they've been pushing Google Home and Google Assistant. It'll be cool to see how that response plays out. They've already got colorful versions of, you know, Google Home Mini, mm-hmm. so they're already a step ahead there. Especially since orange is the best. But we got to stop for a minute to talk about the guys at Thrifter. People who don't know, Thrifter is this weird collection. I say weird. It's a fantastic, please don't yell at me, Dan. It's this collection of just all kinds of deals for everything. It's not explicitly tech. It's not, explicitly cultural. It's just everything that is found on the internet that is on sale right then and there. And it's a cool thing that I found. I'm hooked up to their Twitter feed, you know, at Thrifter Daily. And anytime there's something good, I get a little ping, and sometimes it's just stuff that I didn't know that I needed at the moment, and I grab it, and I'm actually really happy that I have it. So like we have been doing for quite some time, we're going to take a second and go through and just say some of the stuff that's on sale at Thrifter right now that we're a fan of. And because I'm still the one speaking and I don't want Jerry to take it from me, I'm going to go first and say that Alton Brown's new book is called Everyday Cook. It was $15 when it came out earlier this week when I bought it, like an idiot. It is $2 right now on Kindle.
What?
And yeah. So you can get it for $2 for Amazon. And if you're not familiar with Alton Brown, you are just living life wrong. He does just an exceptional job of giving you like the science of how cooking works. And instead of kind of the weird collection of fantasies that most people are taught by moms and grandmas. So it's a really cool way to not just, you know, learn some basic recipes, but understand the science behind how those recipes work. And you just could not spend $2 better. This is a really good book.
Oh, right. I spent $15 on it, too.
Yeah, same
and
here.
And, you know, I guess Russell knows what I read. But it's $2. Buy it. Even if you don't think you're a fan of cooking, buy it. You might change your mind.
Yeah, it's good stuff. It's a very good book. So what do you got, Jerry?
Okay, the Logitech G203 Prodigy RGB wired gaming mouse. All right, a gaming mouse.
Wired gaming mouse.
Yes, and that's the best kind. I'm sorry. What that means is it can track better. They call it DPI, and it stands for dots per inch. A standard mouse has anywhere from, you know, 2,500 to 4,000 DPI. Gaming mice start about 6,000 DPI. Smaller movements can actually show up on your screen, and you need that for playing games. But that's also awesome for everything you do. The problem is, to get a mouse that has that big dot pitch, you have to get these weird, crazy-looking mice that have buttons everywhere and have Call of Duty stickers or whatever on them. This looks like a regular mouse, and it does have a two extra buttons and a scroll wheel, so it's not like it's no features. It looks like a regular mouse. It's wired and it's only $15.
And I think because it's part of the Prodigy RGB series, it's got some weird little app in it that lets you set whatever color you want for the lights on the back of it.
You can install software and there's a
which is the most important part of your mouse, really.
You gotta have lights. Everything has to have LEDs when you hook it up to a computer.
Thankfully, I've got a different Logitech gaming mouse here in front of me, wired. You can shut that light off if you don't want crazy lights all over your desk.
Cool.
So I have used this mouse because, I just try things and I'm stupid. But this one, it's comfortable like a regular mouse and it still feels good to use. It regularly sells for $40 and for $15, it's a no-brainer. If you need a mouse, buy it.
Solid. Andrew, what are you up to this week?
I have a good choice here. The Aki Quick Charge 3.0 10,050 random kind of milliamp hour capacity battery. It's only $20. So this is one, this is kind of that standard Aki one that I think kind of put Aki on the map with their batteries. It's that aluminum kind of extruded pill kind of looking one. Just one USB-A port. Charges over micro USB, that kind of shows how old it is. But $20 for a 10,000 milliamp hour battery that's relatively small. I have one of these and it just slips, it can slip into a jacket pocket, no problem, because it only has one output. But it still has Quick Charge 3.0, plenty of capacity. If you, want to give one of these as a gift or just have one around as a backup, it's great compared to, shopping around and saying, I need three USB ports or I want to have USB-C out and I don't know if this one does the right output, whatever. This is dead simple. USB-A, Quick Charge 3.0, it's going to work for whoever you give it to. And, $20 is a throwaway kind of, no, don't throw it away, recycle it responsibly. But a throwaway, amount of money to get a good backup battery.
Cool. And this is just a small sample of the stuff that happens. The Thrifter team works really hard to get stuff going on the site. There's just constantly new stuff happening up there. It's actually really fascinating to watch that team work. It's so different from the way I think about tech blogging. They are just very, very good at what they do. So thrifter.com or at Thrifter Daily, take a look and you are just about guaranteed to find something cool that is way cheaper than you normally find it.
I eat my tech budget up the first few days of the month every month now that we work with them.
It's not healthy for us.
No, it's for sure. It is. It's great. I get all kind of new stuff and I can get more stuff because it's cheaper.
That's true. So I wanted to shift gears here and actually a whole lot of stuff about Google, and that's We have a lot of stuff to talk about Google. I think this is probably the most Google we're going to talk about before I/O happens. So we need to get all of this out of the way now. And really, the first thing was a very successful financial call. We got the big report from Google that happens every year for stuff that has been going on the past year and how successful Google has been as a company or how Alphabet has been as a company. And there was a lot of good news in there about, money that was made largely from ad revenue. And Andrew noted in the entire earnings call that Google said the word pixel very, very few times.
Yes, I tried to, I listened back through it a couple times. Sundar Pichai, the CEO, said pixel once, as far as I can tell. And he didn't really finish the word. It was kind of like rambling through a bunch of different hardware products. He mentioned like Pixel. And that was a little surprising to me because I listen to these because I'm just crazy for some reason. I listen to these earnings calls every quarter and they always kind of go through the gambit of, and this division is doing this and we're excited about this and we're excited about that. And this is the first full quarter after the Pixel 2 XL launched. It's roughly 6 months after it launched. You would think that they would have some kind of an update. They had nothing to say about it. Of course, I didn't expect it to be a line item in the actual earnings. Like you mentioned, Google still makes
a vast majority of its money off of advertising revenues. It made, you know, whatever, $8 or $7 billion in operating income. That's a lot of money. And, you know, Pixels, even if they were amazingly popular, would be a small sliver of that. But you expect them to say something about it. They had nothing to say at all, one way or the other. And that's just a little moderately disconcerting if you're someone that likes Pixels a lot and follows kind of their success. You don't really care if they sold 50 million or 5 million of them, you know, personally, but you do care about Google continuing to put money into Pixel development. And the only thing they really had to say was about something I hadn't heard Sundar talk about before, is this new hardware effort. Of course, we have a lot of different areas coming together to create, not like a separate company, but this hardware group inside of Google that's doing Google Home stuff and Chromecast and phones and Pixelbooks. And there also includes Nest. They brought Nest over into the Google hardware division, so it's no longer in the other bets kind of land of misfit toys area of Google's earnings. And with this hardware stuff, Sundar was saying, okay, this is a 2 to 3 year plan we're on now. Even though we've done kind of our own hardware stuff off and on for the last few years, now this really is going to go into a new direction. We're working with our own silicon. You know, we're doing things like the Pixel Visual Core. He didn't mention it specifically, but, you know, talking about working on processors, working with these 2,000 new HTC engineers, which just came over in the January-February timeframe, which somehow we already kind of forgot about that. You know, Google added 11,000 employees, but 2,000 of them were just coming from HTC just to do hardware at Google. So they've been doing this building up and this ramping up of this hardware effort. They're going to continue to put money into it, even if they didn't talk about the Pixel specifically right now. And that's your little kind of roller coaster of emotions.
Yeah, we know that it's early days for the hardware plan, especially with the stuff to acquire HTC. And we know that, you know, Dennis Woodside has only been, in charge there for 2 years now. But I think the part of this that surprises me is that we didn't get any information at all, even though this phone, the Pixel 2 in particular, was just advertised to death.
Yeah.
Some of that is personal bias, because I consume media in the channels that Google is likely to blast those advertisements to begin with. But I feel like we got 3 months of just nonstop Pixel advertisements, and it's weird to not hear anything about the results of that.
But most of that was from Verizon.
No, I like the big billboards and stuff. I'm pretty sure that was Google.
Okay,
wasn't it?
I don't know. I was thinking the TV spots, the ones I saw. Were
I know
all
some
Verizon.
Of that was Verizon. Yeah.
But if you want to measure the success of the Pixel phone line, you look at the expenditures and where Google loses money, because that's what Google is losing money to develop things like the Pixel phone. And the more they invest in engineers and fabrication and design, that all goes into their hardware, and they're not building CPUs to put in a Google Home. They're building them for servers, of course, and for phones. It's, you know, the success of the phone, I have no idea. I'm sure it sold more than the last model, and Google says they were happy. They didn't lose money, and that was their goal. So, you know, I assume it's a success for them. But as far as the future, you look at where they're spending money and how much they've spent, and you'll get an idea of how invested they are in the future of the phones. And they're real invested in the future.
Yeah, the two parts about that that you can see in what Google says and what it puts on its earning reports is that the Google other revenues, which is like your hardware division, your Play Store, you know, stuff like that, revenues were up by $1 billion to 4.3 billion. So that's a big move from 3.3 to 4.3 billion in revenues.
And they paid 12% less tax than I did.
Yes, they there was also a little nugget there that their effective tax rate went down, but a large portion of that was a changing in accounting standards, which is extremely nerdy stuff, but their effective tax rate is still like 11%,
yeah,
which is pretty depressing for everybody. But you could tell that when you look at little things like that, the revenues have gone up in the, you know, the other, it's still very small. It's an other revenues kind of line item, and they're not breaking out individual income on that. Like Jerry said, it's not really that important. But the fact that it's denoted as part of Google rather than other bets, it hasn't been spun off. They're very invested in that. And I guess the only other way you could really look at it is, you know, no matter what, even, you know, unless the Pixel sold like 150 million units or something like that, it's not really something that's big enough on the scale of Google. So you remember, this is the earnings call for Alphabet, first of all. It's
sure,
even larger than that. They're covering big things. They're talking about, you know, their product mix of mobile search and desktop search, where they make tens of billions of dollars in revenue. It's just a completely different scale from this hardware stuff.
We're fans of Android, and that's our biggest exposure to Google is through Android. To Google, Android is a loss leader. Google cares a lot about Android and, you know, the Pixel phone, but only because they want you to use Gmail, Google Search. They want you to see the products that they actually make money from. Android is just a vehicle. They don't focus on it the way we do.
So it's a drop in the bucket, and there's no reason to panic, is what I'm hearing from you two.
Definitely.
Which is cool. What I do have a small reason to panic over, just because I wanted it to be better by now, is Google Lens. We gave Bixby Vision a lot of crap when it first came out because it didn't do anything particularly well. And I have tried for a long time to like Google Lens for the things that we were told that it was going to do at Google I.O. And it doesn't do most of them at all yet. And that bugs me a little.
It does them. It just does them very poorly.
No, it does. There are some of those that it does not do at all. Google stood on stage at I.O. and said I was going to be able to point my phone at a movie theater marquee sign, and it was going to know that that was a movie theater marquee sign and take me to a place in Google Search where I could grab tickets for the movies that were listed on the marquee, all from within Google Lens. And I tried 9 different theaters in my area that all had marquee signs just to make sure, and none of them worked.
And you need to keep trying.
I do. That's the thing.
Yeah.
It's a preview. This is not Google Lens as a finished product. It very clearly says all over the place that this is Google Lens preview. And the whole point of the preview program, especially to the Pixel owners who have had it for the longest, is to feed Google's image recognition system more information so that it becomes more accurate over time. Like, I get that.
I remember talking with someone from NVIDIA. NVIDIA demoed a thing, I don't know if it was last year or the year before, where their AI that uses a camera could identify all kinds of stuff just by seeing it in real life or through a picture. And I remember talking with somebody from NVIDIA. They had people sit down for a year and feed this information one piece at a time to the computers so the servers can learn this stuff. Google's depending on us to do a lot of that, and we have to use it for it to get better. It's like Assistant.
It's also super early days for most people. Like I say. I've been using Google Lens for 6 months, but that's because Lens came out as a very early beta as a part of the Pixel, but it didn't actually roll out to every Android phone and the iPhone in Google Photos until last month.
Right.
So most people have only have access to this for a month, and I don't know. It's not something I see or hear a lot of people use. It's definitely not something I see or hear people talk about, which is sad because there are parts of it that do work very well. It does a super good job with like business cards, which is not a particularly popular use case. There aren't a whole lot of, you know, kids walking around going, you know, let me see your business card, good sir. But being able to grab a business card and have it just scrape everything off and add it to contacts is not a new feature. It's something that there have been apps on Android that have been able to do that for a long time, but it's nice to have it rolled into something like Lens, which is already in Google Photos.
But you know what amazes me there? You can print that same information on a full sheet of paper or put it on a business card. It can identify that it's looking at a business card and offer to add the information by itself.
Yeah, because it's the collection of information.
Right.
It doesn't just take the text and read it back to you in a digital format. It's actually taking a look at the general placement of the phone number and the email address and that kind of stuff, and then guessing correctly that it's a business card. And you get the same kind of really cool guesswork for language translation. We have a really cool Afghan restaurant not far from here that has that almost none of the menus that they hand you as you walk in are actually in English. There's like three of them that are in English, but they don't ever decide which one I get. They just hand me whichever one is closest, and more often than not, it is not in the language that I speak, which
That's
is fine because
awesome.
Lens will translate it for me.
And it's also fine because you just pick one and it's going to be delicious anyway.
Yeah, well, that's true for most of it, yeah. But it's the coolest thing about the way that a lot of the live translation stuff happens isn't so much that it's translating the text, it's that it's translating it in the spot on the page.
Yeah.
So that all of the information when you go to read it is in context. You know, the early versions of those would scrape the text and then give you the translation on your phone out of context, which was limitedly useful. But the way that Lens and some of the other apps are able to position the text on the page so that it's in the same spot is just like magic to me sometimes, because it adds that layer of context that is so important for a lot of those kinds of things.
And that's the smart component.
And that's the thing that I think Lens is going to continue to do well is not just doing these kind of one-off tricks, but doing it contextually in a way that I like.
I think we're going to see people noticing Lens more when they allow it to look at their photos. And they look at photos they've taken and say, wow. And they'll, you know, what is this? And they'll look at it a little bit more and see what it can do.
I will say that one thing that it doesn't get right that it really needs to figure out when I have taken photos is guessing the correct breed of my dog.
Yeah. It's...
which is, I keep, it's a joke because I have a Sheltie and it keeps guessing that it's a Collie.
Mm. Oh, well.
Which is, you're right. It makes me laugh every time I see it, because it is the most common thing when I take this dog out is, oh, is that a baby Collie? Like, no, that's a Sheltie.
We have a Dachshund and a Schnauzer, and the Dachshund, it can get every time. I mean, they're easy to identify.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's wintertime, I let the coat grow out on my Schnauzer because he loves to go outside. It has no idea what it's looking at.
Right.
And, you know, I can't be too hard on it because it looks like some sort of monster, a mop that's alive right now. But it'll get better. That's the bad thing about AI is you have to release it as a product that doesn't work
most of the time. Yeah, or you release it as something that you do that does work, and then you wind up with something terrible like Microsoft Tay.
When
there's no control over its growth. Which is a big part of this. Like, I get that the whole deal with the Lens learning period is exactly that. And I'm sure that during I/O, somebody will stand up on stage and say, Lens has consumed this many bajillion images and is now this much smarter because of it. I'm sure that that's what's going to happen next. But.
And in real world use, it's not going to be as nearly as impressive. But one day it will. You got to remember Google Assistant and how horrible it was when it launched with Allo, and then look at it today. It's greatly improved, and it's only going to continue to get better. And that's artificial intelligence is really machine learning. When we use the words AI or artificial intelligence, I kind of hate that, because what we're really describing is machine learning, where we've taught machines things.
What we also saw get better this week, because I'm no better at segues now than I have ever been, is Gmail. Gmail got a series of visual updates that have been kind of rumored for some time now. And if you have gone to Gmail since this update and said, you know, I don't, everything looks exactly the same to me, you got to remember to hit the settings gear on the website. And the very first thing you'll see is try the new Gmail, which is a throwback to, gosh, a long time ago when Gmail last got its big visual overhaul, was the try the new Gmail button. But it's here now, and I kind of dig it. You know, it's not inbox. Inbox is still my favorite for just kind of automatically sorting things. But they've made a lot of the visual changes are straight up, you know, the design language that we've seen from Google for a while now. Mm-hmm. And what do you think about this, Jerry?
I like the new look on the web, but as far as functionality, it's really not that much different. You know, I guess it's nice to have keep and tasks icons on the side. You know, those are things that I actually use. But to me, it's more of a visual overhaul that they're trying to sell me as more functionally. Well, they're not trying to sell it as anything. They haven't said a whole lot about it. But I guess people that write about it, we want to think that it's more functional. And it, to me, I just see mostly a visual change.
Yeah, the only real functional things are smart replies, which is funny because smart replies came to the regular Gmail app on Android, and snoozing, and
but not
stuff
all
like
of
that.
Snoozing. Only part of snoozing from inbox came over. You can, and I don't understand that. You can snooze by time, but you can't snooze by place.
Hmm, interesting.
Which is the most useful part of inbox to me. Like, if I'm going to New York for something, anything that's related to that trip, I will snooze until I get to a specific location. And then when I get there, it's just all at the top of my box. And maybe it's just because the mobile version of this update has not rolled out yet.
That's very possible, yeah. It doesn't have the hooks for that yet, I suppose.
But yeah, it's... You know, it's weird to only see part of the snooze function there compared to what you have in inbox. Or maybe I'm the only person who uses the location snoozing. I don't know.
I don't use inbox at all.
See, that's the thing. I've got a snoozed category underneath inbox and starred. I'm sitting here looking at it now, but I don't see smart replies or snoozing in any of my messages and haven't yet. So I don't understand, you know, is it a setting that I had before, because I had my inbox pretty customized with some of the Google Labs you could use before. So maybe I've done something that makes it not work, but I don't. And I've seen videos and stuff where you scroll through and it's a pop-up on the side where you can snooze and trash or hit the smart reply button. I don't have that. So if you don't have it, you're not alone.
I get the feeling that this is just a visual thing. I have to say that I'm a much bigger fan of tasks not looking like something from Android 1.0. just because the tasks interface for Gmail was just horrible looking. It was.
I think you could just apply that across the entire visual portion of this redesign. Is that Gmail did feel pretty old.
Dated. Yeah,
it felt it had very a utilitarian feel to it. Because it was. I mean, it wasn't trying to be. The funny thing is, instead of redesigning it earlier, they just made inbox, which is like, hey, we don't have much of this baggage of like the way that all these power users use Gmail. So when we design inbox, we're just going to make it a lot cleaner and simpler. And it's not going to have all of this legacy stuff that, you know, hardcore computer users expect out of their email, you know, inbox.
Which is cool. And I know, having worked, you know, for a company that did email for a small town for a while, the one thing for non-techie people you just don't mess with the email client. Like anytime you're like, hey, I'm rolling out this visual thing and it's going to be super cool and everyone's going to love it, you are going to get a million emails the next day telling you how terrible that change is and how you need to revert it right then and there. Like I've worked for companies that everyone in the office was so excited about this email change and it was just going to make everyone's life so much better. And no, we had no idea what we were talking about. We should feel bad and this should stop immediately. It was really fascinating.
The one thing I'm noticing that I don't really care. Well, I really like this little sidebar you can get on the right side that can show calendar, keep, and tasks by default, and then you can add more stuff. The calendar doesn't show subscribed calendars.
Oh, interesting.
It only shows your actual, my events that I've created.
I think I kind of dig that, though, because sometimes my shared calendar is just really congested.
Yeah, I mean, the way that I have lots of subscribe calendars, and so I just want to know what's going on. It's just very interesting that that's not an option. But again, like Jerry is saying, this hasn't really been finalized or rolled out to everybody in the same way. The reason why you have to enable it, you know, is because of that thing Russell was talking about. You don't want to just turn this on for everybody right at the start and find out how terrible it is immediately.
And the rollout has been very slow. Like there's a button there to enable it manually, but I don't know a whole lot of people who just woke up to this update.
I didn't even have the button to enable it manually at first.
Yeah. So I think Google knows this, you know, the dread of email change better than most. And I think they're being very, very cautious with the update.
Now I have the sidebar and I did look through the add-ons and there are some cool things there you can do. It lets me talk.
The G Suite marketplace.
Yeah. But what's missing there is a tie-in with my Google messaging clients. Why can't I have a button that takes me to Allo or Hangouts on the web? Because I use those. And I used to use an old Google Labs widget that put chat in my Gmail page.
Well, Hangouts is still on the left-hand side under the inbox for me.
Oh, see? Mine disappeared, my widget.
Yeah, I still
this
have
a mess.
The left-hand. It still looks like old-school GChat.
Yeah, I know. I had that same widget here, and it disappeared when I updated. This whole rollout's just a mess. Fix it, Google.
Yeah, so maybe not so exciting. But we did get an update to Google Tasks. So it does not look like it was assembled in the 1800s anymore. And it's still really, really basic, though. It's I don't know. I don't think they could have made it
gain
as
plain
a lot
of features.
Possible. No, it's definitely just a visual update. And, you know, it frustrated me, I guess, when I saw the Gmail update and I saw that it was right underneath of Google Keep. There's no Google Keep interaction. Like it doesn't tie into Google Keep whatsoever,
which
kind of seemed like an obvious thing. Like that seemed like an obvious button to make, to make tasks and Keep play nice together,
or just make them the same thing,
right? And I think my favorite criticism of this to date is actually the folks at Android Police, Rita Kauri. Oh man, I hope I didn't just mess up her last name. I think I did though. She had just a list of all of the things that Tasks is missing. And I think it was like 15 or 16 things long. And each one of them, I was like, yeah, that's definitely missing. Like it was just brutal.
I like it. I like it that
it's very
basic,
clean.
And it only does one small thing because that's the one thing I would use it for. I use Keep for all the other features and I can share it with my wife. I've got, you know, like here's a shopping list and all kind of stuff that it just works, and I can do a little bit more with Keep. And for people who need even more, there's things like Evernote. But for something dead simple that's just basically Notepad in your Gmail, that's what Tasks is, and I love that. It kept all my old tasks from before, and it's just...
Yeah, it did that.
It just fits in better. I like that part of the update.
It looks nice. I just feel like they broke it out into a separate app and then didn't give me any functionality that made having a separate app worth it. Like I already have a Notepad app on my phone.
I can agree as far as the phone app. Yes.
And really like the thing that Tasks does well, has always done well is if you have a calendar invite for something, you can stick it in that task for more information. And I want that for keep. You know, if I have a note or if I have a task that I've given myself, but it's part of a shared thing, I'm not necessarily excited about sharing tasks so much as I am like, here, there's more information on this other Google product that I can link to in the same way that I can embed calendar stuff. Because the calendar embed thing is really cool.
And if you, you know, like if you add a calendar event from an email, it'll give you the reference back to that email as well.
Yeah. 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 So there's cool stuff that it does.
If you think back, what, about a year and a half ago when we first heard that Hangouts was going to finally go away one day, Google had stressed how they want to simplify their tools because you go into the settings of Hangouts and it's, unless you're one of us or somebody listening to this podcast, you're absolutely lost. Yeah. And they're absolutely right that that's just too much. But maybe they've gone too far the other direction and things are just too simple. We want to be able to embed a calendar task into Keep, and we think that'd be a great, easy feature. Maybe they think it would be confusing. I think they're wrong, but that would explain some of the dumbing down of this stuff. And I hate to use that word, but...
We also saw, design nerds got really excited about this. There is a slight difference. There's a deviation from what we know as material design in the Tasks app with the menu system.
Yeah.
There's no left-hand slide-in menu like we see in every single Google app now. It slides up from the bottom, which was interesting. And I poked the bear a little bit by saying that seemed like the kind of design change that you would make across your entire platform if you were considering a mobile UI that was gesture-based instead of what we have right now.
Man, I can't think of the development language that Google is using for their new test operating system. You call it Fuchsia, whatever you want to call it. But the development language they use, the examples, all use this type of menu.
Yeah.
And that's the first thing I thought of when... You know, I saw, especially the completed tasks. I've got a huge list of completed tasks. And if I click that arrow up, I get a nice, smooth transition that really reminded me of what I've seen for, you know, what we think are their plans for their next phone update. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah, that is cool. And, you know, I'm sure that we will see more. We always get some design language stuff at I/O, and that's not too far from now. So what we're probably seeing here is kind of a precursor to the changes that will be made moving forward. Or, you know, maybe they'll surprise us with something big.
I want to see this design with the menu from the bottom that slides up in the YouTube app. I watch YouTube.
Oh, yeah.
I watch YouTube vertical, and you tap a video, and you don't get to see much underneath the video. You could use this and it could slide up as, you know, like an overlay above the video. I would like that.
Well, where we're not going to see this UI change anytime soon, most likely, is from the folks at GameStash, who are our other sponsor this week, which I wanted to take a minute and talk about real quick. GameStash is just a collection of games and gaming services where they've ripped out all of the stuff that kind of nickel and dimes you for a game. You know, so you go and play a game, all of the kind of pay to win stuff. It's the same game. You know, it's the same game that you would get from the Play Store. But all of the payment stuff has been ripped out in exchange for a monthly fee that you would pay for this Netflix style queue of all of these games that you want. And if you want to check it out, you have a 14-day free trial that you can get from us. You just head to gamestash.com/ACPOD. It's AC Pod. And they'll hook you up with 14 days of the GameStash setup where, like I said, you can go through and play really just as many of these games as you want. And you don't have to worry about any of them asking you for any kind of payment in order to gain a competitive edge in the game.
EA should look into doing that.
EA should look into finding
out how extorting people.
Yeah. Not extorting people.
They should probably just follow Activision and stop.
Or telling people that games with linear storylines aren't selling anymore. Because I don't know if they've heard of Gears of War or God of War, but it's selling pretty well right now. So LG has this phone that we know is coming out soon with this name that I really don't like.
G7.
That's right, G7. It is the LG G7 ThinQ. And the ThinQ brand is something that LG has tacked onto a ton of stuff, isn't it? It's like washers and dryers and televisions.
It's basically their thing to denote that the thing is smart, which is hilarious because everything is smart. So they could just presumably put this on every single thing they make.
Yeah, I think ThinQ is on my washer and dryer downstairs. So that's so we have the LG G7 ThinQ, which we've known has been coming out for a while now. We know that LG is really hoping that this phone is kind of a return to glory for LG in the phone arena. And we got some solid renders of this new phone, and it looks, I don't know, it looks exactly like an LG phone to me. Like this,
it looks like a V30.
Right. It looks
with,
like a
with an
you
extra
know,
button.
We've got cameras, a pair of cameras on the back, fingerprint sensor on the back, where it belongs. Do not at me. And you know, fingerprint sensor. It looks like we're sticking with laser autofocus. You know, it's fairly standard looking LG phone to me. Yeah. It's got a notch on the display. It's a notch phone,
which is fine.
Yeah,
no, it's not. I mean, stop saying that, or people will believe it. It's not fine. It sucks. It's stupid.
It's a thing that exists. It's something. What I will say is that even though this phone has the render that we have here, even though the phone has a notch on the top, there's still a little bit of space on the bottom that is not display. It's not, the display does not run flush all the way to the bottom of the panel, right, like we've seen with
which
some other phones.
Is the redeeming quality, in my opinion, because when you're holding your phone in landscape, you need somewhere to put your thumb.
I love you, Jerry.
Hey, that's, I can't use some of these new phones.
No, I get it. I get
it. And I'm actually worried that, you know, next year there's not going to be a phone in the market that I can use unless, you know, somebody builds something that looks like an old BlackBerry Pearl, or, you know, what am I going to do? I have full range of motion of my hands, but they're big, meaty, nasty hooks that hang off my arms, and I can't deal with it. So I'm glad to see a little bit of space. Please continue that trend, LG.
But the other part of that, though, is that LG, as it does, just came out and confirmed more of the specs and kind of size and shape of this thing by giving us specs for the display. Mm-hmm. So it's super, super, super tall. It's 19.5:9 aspect ratio at 6.1 inches diagonally.
Wow.
That's really tall. So when you add in the fact that it still has the bezels on the top and bottom, that's just a really, I mean, we don't know the exact dimensions of the phone, but that's just a really tall phone. So it's going to be very similar to the Galaxy S9 Plus.
I think the best thing about the way that they've handled this is not just the hardware, but the software. There's a way to disable the notch.
Yeah.
In the software, it just blacks out the stuff up top and moves the rounded white, you know, to down a little bit, so that you just never see that there's a notch there.
It's just as if you had a black status bar with no notch.
Right. It only, you know, the black status bar is not going to be functional in the middle. It's really funny that there is a button to disable the notch in software,
which is just like Huawei does on the P20.
Right.
You know, supposedly the next version of Android isn't going to put anything there anyway.
Yeah, because they'll be able to, LG will be able to define that there's a notch there, and so it won't put anything there anyway.
So we have this super tall 6.1 inch. I assume we're sticking with LCD because it's LG.
Yeah, so that's the one interesting thing is they did LCD on the G6, and then they went, they have not a great reputation with OLED on the V30 and the Pixel 2 XL. So they're going back to LCD, but it's an IPS LCD.
And no, it's an MLCD. This is something new.
They just said IPS LCD. That's all they said.
Well, it's the actual specs. It's an MLCD, which is still an LCD with a new underlay technology. Kind of cool, right, to nerds.
So the big thing is that they're saying that it
will go a minimum of 1,000 nits of brightness, yep, which isn't quite Samsung level. No, it's not Samsung OLED level, but it's pretty darn close. And it's one of the... So LG has kind of had two complaints. It's either you get an LCD that looks pretty good but doesn't really get bright, or you have an OLED that gets quite a bit brighter, but the colors and the saturation and color banding and things are a little weird. So they're going back to LCD and like the G6. But if it's 1,000 nits, that's going to be fantastic.
That's going to be great. How funny is it that LG as a company, like the overall company LG, is just owning the Super AMOLED market in televisions that are like 55 inch and higher? Like the LG is just like the top selling in all of those things, but cannot make a 6-inch AMOLED panel to save its life
at all.
It's amazing to me.
And I am not saying this as any type of huge LG fan or an investor. Their OLED TVs are far and above better than everything else in the market.
Oh, they're so good, yeah.
Go look at them, and yes, they're in a weird display mode, but go look at them on the showroom floor somewhere. They're visibly better than the competition. And it's got to be their market focus. LG wanted to capture that market, and Samsung wanted to capture the smaller market, so their manufacturing techniques are specialized for it. That's got to be, I can't think of any other reason why.
And well, the craziest thing about that whole situation is that LG Display is just a subsection of LG. They have a dedicated display company or division that makes displays for all kinds of things.
Yep.
Not even just in the mobile and TV space, just all kinds of things. They make displays just like LG Chem makes batteries. They're doing this R&D for all these displays, and it shows in their TVs. It's just we hold them to, I think, understandably, a higher standard because of that.
Now, Jerry, we also saw from LG that their profits in this quarter for 2018 were great. They were record profits, even though not a lot of people are buying these phones. Is that because of the televisions?
Well, I think, you know, televisions are a big part of it, but you make that a little bit bigger. There's, you know, appliances and other entertainment devices. LG makes speakers and, you know, entertainment center receivers and all kind of stuff that are pretty good. They're priced competitively and they're wildly popular. That's got to be a moneymaker. They don't depend on the phone.
Well, and those TVs are so expensive when they first come out, and then they drop in price pretty quickly. So they got to be making money off of those.
Yep. And but you know, people are buying those expensive TVs because they're so damn good, and that's, you know, LG is just leaning on that to support the entire company, which is okay. We want their phones to continue to improve and for them to keep fighting for the number one spot there. But as a company, LG is doing just fine.
Right. So the big move right now for LG is their mobile communications division. They just call it MC usually, it's always had very high revenues because they're in a lot of markets and they move a lot of product, like volume wise, but their costs have always been massive. So their revenues for the mobile communications division are roughly half of what the home entertainment side is, which is crazy if you think about the fact that, like we were saying, their home entertainment division is massively popular, successful, huge. The mobile communications division is pulling in half as much revenue, which is a lot considering that we don't always think of LG in the mobile space as being huge.
Right.
The problem is it's losing money, you know, on an operating basis. So their biggest thing right now is they have, the mobile communications division has $2 billion in revenue for the quarter, but it's still losing, not a lot, but they're losing like $150-ish million dollars per quarter. Now, So LG's big thing right now is like, hey, we have this huge revenue source. It's pulling in a lot of money. And because we're so big, it doesn't really matter that it's losing this smaller amount of money. So what they're doing is they're doing lots of restructuring, lots of, I don't want to say cost cutting, but cost analysis of like, hey, we're actually, because we're pulling in so much money, we're actually just, you know, we're within optimization range of being break even on mobile communications, which is very a good position to be versus being in a position where you don't even have the revenue to support making money, even if, you know, even if your costs are zero.
It's exactly where Samsung was prior to the first Galaxy S phone. Samsung leaned on the other revenue because Samsung is an even bigger company than LG and makes money everywhere and could afford to just barely break even or even lose a little bit of money for their phones and tablets. And they have worked things out that they have such an effective manufacturing system. And, you know, from the design to the completion and put it in the box, Samsung is monitoring every penny and makes a lot of money.
Yeah. And you just have to, when you look at these numbers, as I followed the LG earnings kind of as they trickle out every quarter, you notice that they've always had extremely high revenues and relatively small operating income or operating loss. It's not particularly large. I mean, even when you talk about the home entertainment group, that's you know, their operating profit was only $500 million. That's not a lot of money for a massive multinational corporation compared to, we were just talking about Google making $7 billion in operating income. So they're right, you know, in that range. They have lots of revenue. So, you know, there was lots of talk a couple quarters ago because they had a really bad quarter where they didn't sell that many phones and things were way off, that, oh, well, maybe they'll just get out of the business. I don't think that when you have a single division that has $2 billion in revenue in the quarter that you just, you know, toss it to the side.
Absolutely. And if you don't already know this, next time you're at the mall or somewhere, check out a T-Mobile store. Walk in and look at the cheap phones or phones that they give you for free. Most of them are made by LG. LG makes a lot of phones that we don't talk about because they're just middling phones that don't catch your eye. If they can find a way to make money on each one of those, that's going to be huge.
That's true. Yeah, I mean, it's there, and it's every store. It's not just, you know, it's not just, well, we have, you know, a deal with Verizon or a deal with T-Mobile or anything. It's pretty much all, you know, LG is spread, you know, they're especially their budget market phones are pretty much everywhere. And from a lot of what we've seen, I'm excited by the stuff that we've seen so far with the G7. I think that people are going to cling to it for a lot of the same reasons that they've been kind of leaning away from other phones.
I think this is probably going to be my 2018 phone because it's set up in a way that I can use it. And, you know, unless the Pixel or another phone comes out with a way to give me space to hold it like the G7 does, or, you know, maybe these renders are all wrong too. I don't know. But that's, LG is doing something at least a little bit different, and I want to think they're doing it for people like me who want that, but I'm sure there's another reason they're not doing it for me. But I like seeing it. I think this is probably going to be the phone that I end up using.
Well, that might be true, or we might be waiting in 2 or 3 weeks to see how you feel about the OnePlus 6.
Yep.
Because that is on the way here too. We got an official announcement saying that it's going to be, they're doing a London event on May 16th, which means it's going to be live streamed to a whole bunch of places. No word about a small army of pop up tents like we've seen them do in other cities in the past. But
that's kind of just a given.
Yeah, and that's just how they roll. Is a whole bunch of places for you to go and kind of check it out in hand and see. Not a ton of details, but before that announcement came out, Pete Lau actually confirmed after a rumor about it, the phone possibly having a ceramic back, that this one's going to have a glass back like every freaking thing else.
Yeah.
which made me sad because a ceramic back would have been like a cool way to stand apart. But they did say that it was going to have a glass back. I forget. Did that also include mention of wireless charging, or is this just a glass back because?
I think it's the latter.
That would make me incredibly sad if this was the functionality argument, I'm on board with. We put a glass back on this phone so that it could have wireless charging. Not we put a glass back on this phone because it looked pretty when we saw it. Like that's
the flip side of that is we put wireless charging in this phone and now we have to charge $19 more for it. And people say, oh, you're ripping us off. We want your cheap phones. And it's a huge backlash.
Having a glass back on this phone is definitely going to increase the cost. So
well, but wireless charging will increase it even more.
Sure.
Somebody has to pay for the rights to use that stuff.
The licensing and stuff like that.
I don't think we're going to see it. I'm really interested. I used to think OnePlus made excellent hardware, but I had problems with their software until I made some incorrect assumptions and sat down and talked with some people from the company and found out what they do and why they do it and how they do it. And now I'm more interested in the company than ever.
Yeah, I mean it's a cool thing, and you know one of the things that they've it's not just glass. They've also been talking about what they're calling 5 printed layers of nanotech coating, which they say is a first in the smartphone industry, and absolutely sounds like gibberish. But I'm excited to see there are 5 layers of this coating instead of 3. Maybe they're talking about the oleophobic layer that is on you know so many phones. Maybe the mm-hmm. this is supposed to be an extra durable layer of oleophobic coating to keep oils off of the phone so it'll last longer than most other phones because that's something Alex talks about a lot is using phones the oleophobic layer wears off. He yep. usually notices it a little earlier than most of us do.
He must have poison in his thumb.
That's right.
And you always you as a phone maker, you know, listening to this podcast, you always have this trade-off with all these phones that are really glassy, especially phones like the, especially if you look at like the Note 8 and Galaxy S8, because even their metal was kind of like glass. You have to make this trade-off of, do you put lots of oleophobic coating on it where the screen won't smudge up? Or do, you know, and the back won't smudge up, or do you skip that, which means you could actually hold on to the phone? Because if you have a glass back that has lots of oleophobic and hydrophobic coatings on it, it just flies out of your hand, because part of what those oils in your hand do is give you a little bit of friction so that you can actually adhere, you know, slightly your fingers to the back of the phone, and you kind of get that thing where you could hold it in one hand without, you know, sticking your pinky underneath the bottom of the phone. And if you're talking about a big phone with a glass back and curved sides and an oleophobic coating on the back, you know, is it going to be like a bar of soap?
Imagine if the iPhone 4 and the Nexus 4, I think all three of us remember how horribly slippery the backs were. Imagine
I hated the Nexus 4.
Imagine if they were a 6-inch phone and you had to try to hold that.
Oh yeah. Yeah, it's you know, there's a delicate balance that has to be struck there, like Andrew said. I definitely agree with that.
I hope and I'm sure it's not, but these coatings that they're putting on glass, I want to see a hydrophobic and an antibacterial layer put into the glass on phones. There's no reason other than cost that they can't do it, but that's just things that we're missing since I'm just going to sit here and make a wish list. I'm sorry.
We need someone like Elon Musk to get in and make a phone so that it has like a biohazard mode for when it detects that you have gone into a bathroom. And just immediately turns on built-in, you know, blue LEDs to purify your phone before you touch it.
And then only make 11 of them.
That's right, only make 11 of them. So the other thing that we saw from the presentation that they gave us about the glass design as a response to this this ceramic rumor, a lot of very specific language used about the glass design and how it was centered around having a sense of value and a premium hand feel.
There is not a phrase that I hate more in this industry
than hand feel.
It's
like mouthfeel in the foodie world.
Yeah, it's super gross to read and then to hear someone say, especially when you're standing next to them and you're holding the phone, like a PR person starts talking about the hand feel, I immediately want to put the phone down and walk away because my hand now feels gross. But the language being used here really says to me that we're going to see a price hike on this phone again.
What if our phone was more expensive?
That's right. A lot of this is they're talking a lot about, you know, this is, it's a premium to the touch phone. And this is, you know, we've put a lot of work into this and you really want to closely examine it. And you'll see it's, you know, the subtle nuance embedded in each device. This feels an awful lot like slowly preparing their audience for a phone that is more expensive than the previous one.
Look, they've done this year after year after year.
It's been a price hike every year.
They do this perfect, like midnight infomercial version of a phone launch where they say, look, it has this and this and this. And what would you expect to pay for that? $800, but we'll give it to you for $600. What do you, you know, plus processing and handling. Like, it's always going to be like that. But I agree, they're going a little extra on this when they start talking about the fanciful design and the different things they're going to add. And you have to wonder, you know, where that upper limit is. I mean, we already talked about this with the 5T having an option that's over $500.
It has to come. I mean, the 5T has a $500 option, while the Galaxy Note 8 or the Pixel XL have a $1,090 option.
I'm fine with a premium option, but to counter that point, Jerry, like the S9, it came down in price pretty quick.
Yeah, and
it's hard to, you know, it's hard to see a new phone like the OnePlus 6. You know, people are going to be wanting to know if this is the phone they should be getting over the S9. In some cases, the S9 you can get from a carrier for $500 and $600 now.
And the OnePlus 6 is not going to drop in price as much as something like the S9. So
they're never on sale long enough.
Yeah.
They stay really close to their price.
So there's not going to be a surplus. And I mean, yeah, there's that too. And that's not a good position for OnePlus to be in, where customers have to decide between the OnePlus 6 and the Galaxy S9 at the same price. That's, no company wants to be in that position except Samsung.
So what's your guess, Russell?
I'm pretty sure it's going to be, we're looking at a $650 or $700 phone.
Dang.
And possibly even with a special premium version that is another $100 up from that. Because, you know, to OnePlus's defense, they do have fans that just like the phones and are cool with paying whatever the price is. You know, because they like what that company is all about. And so I feel like having a premium version of whatever phone they sell is a good idea. You know, maybe a 128 gig version that has a special, like the P20, you know, where it's got that special gradient on the back. You know, maybe like a really premium looking version of the OnePlus 6, you know, for $100 more or whatever. I'm fully on board with that, but I would be surprised to see this phone be under $650. When it gets announced.
Okay, what if they would, 3 months from now, release a successor to like the OnePlus X that's $395? Does that make it okay for them to make a $700 phone?
Mm. I mean, they can make the phones whatever price they want.
In our eyes, does that make it okay? Do we excuse the fact that their phones have risen in price to, you know, be close to the companies they used to point out as being too expensive, as long as they still make an option that's
sure,
good and cheap?
Yeah.
I think I excuse it regardless, because they obviously have seen that it works.
I do too, because there's a reason that these phones are so expensive. And yes, 20 to 30% of it is because these companies just want to take your money. That's how companies exist. But year after year, every single part gets more expensive. I have no problem that the prices keep rising. I hate to see them, you know, as high as they are. But if this phone is really good and it's $600, I can't complain.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, that's what this comes down to, right? Like the thing that we did with OnePlus when they first came out, the phones were okay, but they were at a really good price. And so we had a lot of reaction from people where it was a great phone for the price, that for the price hedge at the end of whether it was a great phone or not. And the problem that I personally ran into with the 5T was, you know, as the price came up, the level of quality, in particular in the software, did not rise at a commensurate rate. You know, there were still a lot of problems, in particular with updates, that did not meet the standards of the companies they were competing with.
Right. And the part for me is also the camera, that if this thing, I would guess it's going to be $599, just so that they can say they're under $600. I'm not sure about that, obviously. I'm just guessing, but you know, 600, 650, whatever, they can't take any shortcuts in the camera. That's just not going to, you can't do that because the Pixel 2 is $650 and it will blow the pants off of it.
There will be shortcuts in the camera.
Right.
OnePlus is not.
Of course, we know it will. I'm just saying that's going to be a way, you know, we've always been able to do that for the price thing. We've always been able to say, well, but it's $200 less, you know, like the 5T is $499 or whatever it is, or whatever it was.
I feel you. Because of the way things are, OnePlus, and, you know, they may have a huge parent company that funds them, they don't have the ability to compete when it comes to the type of technology they need to make a camera as good as the Note 8 or the Pixel XL. They just don't. And if they would do it, their prices would skyrocket because they would have to pay a lot more money to get that into their phone because they don't have the ability to manufacture or engineer this type of thing like Samsung or Google does.
I think that's right. And I hope that, you know, that, you know, outside of what will inevitably be the midnight television sales pitch, as Andrew put it, that we get a pretty decent phone on the other end of that announcement.
You know what? I'm saying $549.
$549?
I think they're going to try to keep it as close to the price of the 5T and still make a margin as they can.
I think that would be super cool if they were able to pull that off, but I don't know that that's how that's going to go. But on that, I think we're gonna call this an episode.
A long episode.
Yeah, we covered quite a bit here. So that was, like I said, episode 380. I'm gonna go watch some Avengers do some things. I'm guessing they're gonna fight some bad guys.
Just think, if you had a OnePlus 6 Avengers limited edition,
you know what?
Phone.
That's the one thing. Yeah, we didn't talk about that. It's probably they're gonna do a Avengers edition of the OnePlus 6. But it's probably only going to be in India because the Star Wars OnePlus 6 was only in India. And that makes me... Maybe that's why I'm so salty about this, because I'm never going to get an Avengers phone.
Harish will have one and he'll show you pictures of it just because he knows how much you want it and he'll be able to revel in the fact that you don't have one.
I'm going to India. I'm gonna go sleep in Harish's bed. Dude, and I'm not going to get out until he gives me the phone.
If we're going to India, I'm going. I want to meet my inner self with some of those gurus.
That's amazing. There's no possible way we could end this any better than that. Andrew, Jerry, thank you very much for joining me this week. Andrew, your voice survived until the end, which
yes.
is amazing.
I've had to mute myself multiple times, but I made it.
Together we triumph. All right. Be sure to take a look at Android Central in particular this week for all of the exciting, cool new things that are coming for really just everything as we get ready for Google I.O. You know, we're going to have, I'm sure, just a ton to talk about once that happens in 2 weeks. But until then, Andrew, where do people find you on the internet?
At Andrew Martinik on all of the things. You can at me. Go for it.
Jerry, where are you at?
I guess I'm at GBHIL on Twitter. I'm still taking a break from social media and the meanness that's attached to it. But I do
that's
read
admirable.
It. I read it once in a while. So if you need me for something, I'll probably see it.
Cool. And I am at Russell Holly, and thanks for listening. Have a good night or day or whatever time it is. I don't know why I said that.
Bye-bye.
Well, adios.